caterpillars rule the streets, destroy whole city blocks, while children swallow shrapnel for the crime of throwing rocks. Fences are erected around the towns they flatten, and Herzl's own fanatics sleep on sheets of satin while they water their plantations, drilling ever deeper wells, while the displaced children of the hopeless are filled with bullet shells. The words you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the settlers return to Tel Aviv. On one side there's the Mossad rounding up the men, thrown in jail with no trial, being tortured once again. On the other there is rage, helplessness and fear, and a growing realization that another Holocaust is near. On the outside there are prisons, inside detainees, being stripped of their humanity, beaten naked on their knees. Outside the prison walls, stormtroopers all around, while inside the hungry people yearn for liberated ground. The words you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the jail guards return to Tel Aviv. All across the world, you can hear the people say, the children of Jerusalem will be free one day. In overcrowded camps amidst the stench of death and flies to the suburbs of Detroit, you can hear the anguish cries. While in the land of Israel, with God ever on their side, walls and fences are constructed, papers are denied. People fight for their existence while the world turns a blinded eye, and those who should know better insist on asking why. The words you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the refugees return to Tel Aviv.
That was local musician David Rovix playing to a crowd of protesters in Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland Saturday. The protest called for an end to the Israeli attack on Gaza, which has killed close to 200 Palestinians in less than a week, including whole families and babies. Palestinian factions had called for a ceasefire beginning on July 6th, before the Israeli attack began in force, but Israeli authorities have refused to agree to a ceasefire, saying that they intend to wipe out Hamas completely.
The time is 6:02, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland 90.7 Community Radio. Up next is Labor Radio, and at 6:30 is Prison Pipeline, and at 7 it's Hard Knock Radio, so please stay tuned.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, or perhaps you're streaming our show online. Welcome to this edition of Labor Radio, bringing you the news and views of, by, and for working people every Monday night at 6 p.m. Today's show features an interview with Joe Burns. He's a union negotiator, attorney, and the author of two books. His first, Reviving the Strike, and his latest book, Strike Back, about public employee strikes, was just released.
Now, time for the bullet. Let's the bullet. Let's the bullet. Let's labor rate radio. Time. For the working, the clashes, educate, organize, activate, yeah, the time is now, look up to the past, to the 30s, yeah, the sit down, the strike, it's time to make things right, we've been taking it for far too long, the labor movement getting real strong, we the cold. We got Labor Radio with your host, Megan and Mayor.
Okay, my name is Megan. I'm your host for this evening, and I have Joe Burns on the phone. We're going to talk about his new book, Strike Back. After writing Reviving the Strike, you've come out with a book focusing on public employee unions. Why public employee unions?
Well, when I wrote Reviving the Strike, I mainly focused on the experience of private sector workers from the 1930s through the 1970s, and demonstrated that a powerful strike had really was responsible for the creation of the modern labor movement in the private sector. But a lot of the workers, when I went around and talked about reviving the strike, were public sector workers, and public sector workers nowadays constitute about half of union membership. So it's a very important area of union membership. And even beyond that, public sector unionism is under incredible attack today. So for those reasons, I started to look at the experience of the public employee strike wave of the 1960s and decided that there was a lot of lessons that we could learn from that period. So, you know, began writing and ultimately finished my second book, Strike Back.
And it was the strike that actually helped, in a lot of ways, public employees gain the rights to collective bargaining. Is that true?
Yeah, that's very much the truth. And when I was a hospital worker in the 1990s, and I was a public employee and local union president. And I think in the official histories of the union, the role of the strike in both creating our unions in the public sector and changing the laws was really downplayed. And it was really talked a lot more about legislation being passed. But when you study the period, it becomes crystal clear that the strike really created the modern public employee labor movement in state after state. It's how workers forced politicians to recognize their unions and to help raise the wages and working conditions of public employees. And then even beyond that, you know, the evidence is really clear in state after state that bargaining only became legal, or striking, in fact, became legal in many states after public employees engaged in this very militant, illegal strike wave that, you know, involved hundreds of thousands of public workers during the period.
It seems like your book couldn't come at a better time, given the attack on public employee unions that we've seen over the last few years and the sort of air of fight back that we've seen rise to confront that with the, you know, first the Chicago teacher strike, and so many public employee unions have been able to revive, if not the strike, definitely the strike threat and a fight back mentality. So what kind of prescriptions or advice do you have for a public employee union member who's dealing with this political climate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear in studying history that public employee unions were formed because of grassroots activism and struggle. So I think that's really the, you know, one of the key lessons from the period is that, you know, in recent decades, a lot of public employee unions have gotten complacent. They've become staff-run and have tried to exist by accommodation with politicians and the very forces who are trying to dismantle public education and public service. So I think the lesson from the period is that you really need to involve the members and really be willing to fight back. And indeed, that's what we're seeing in recent years. In teacher unions, there's not just the Chicago teachers, which is the best example, but really inspired by them. You have caucuses forming in a lot of teacher unions. You have people pushing at their conventions that are going on this week, this last week, for both the Education Association and the AFT. So I think increasingly you're going to see that in the public sector, that in order to preserve unionism, we're going to have to return to the grassroots activism.
Do you talk in your book about episodes in our history where public employees have built alliances with the communities they serve? We've been dealing with this wave of austerity, and there's this new energy to form labor community alliances, which seems to be working. But what does history tell us about that kind of activity?
Yeah, I think what public employees describe it as, so beginning with the New York teachers in New York City in 1916, you have this incredible strike wave of public employees that really hundreds of thousands of employees striking throughout the 60s. And by the mid-70s, you have public employee unionism very well established. But you also saw during that period the beginning and the rise of a conservative movement, which would ultimately sweep Ronald Reagan into power. But that conservative movement, much like today, funded by corporate millionaires and billionaires, was very much focused on attacking public employee unions. So by the mid-1970s, many public employers, and this was Democrats and Republicans alike, were attacking public employees and blaming them for the fiscal woes of cities throughout the country. So public employee unions, the more perceptive ones, began to understand that they needed to change their tactics, and just doing straight-up strikes would not work, and that they needed to begin to run their strikes not so much as straight-up economic actions, but as part of an overall political mobilization that very much involved forging very deep ties with the community. And this was very much based on the idea, which was prevalent if you read the literature, the Law Review articles, and labor study journals of the period, is that people understand that the fundamental economics of a private sector strike and a public employee strike are fundamentally different. In a private sector strike, if you're striking a grocery store or an auto work plant, what you're trying to do is, hopefully stop production so that the employer loses money during the strike. In a public employee strike, in contrast, the employer typically saves money. They continue to collect their tax revenue, but they're not paying the workers. So if Department of Vehicle Services workers go out on strike, it's not like the employer doesn't still collect taxes. The reason that the strike is won or lost is because of the political pressure that the workers are able to garner from the community because of the disruption to services and so forth, and that's really key to winning a strike. So what you've seen in recent years is public employee unions that have done the groundwork and garnered their or tailored their message correctly have done well, such as the Chicago teachers. In contrast, in situations where the groundwork really wasn't done correctly and the message wasn't able to get out that great, then the strikes didn't end as well, such as in the BART strike in the Bay Area of California.
So let's talk about a little bit of fun stuff. You have a chapter called The Blue Flu, Work to Rule and Other Non-Strike Tactics. That I think that's interesting. What options are on the table for public employees to flex their muscles besides the decision to stop delivering services?
Okay, with striking illegal throughout the 1960s, public employees were really free to be creative. Since all of the tactics were illegal, they experimented and tried different forms of striking. And some of the tactics that they tried would be familiar to us today. So, for example, various occupational groups in the 1960s, rather than do a straight-out strike, which really, if you do a straight-out strike, it challenges the authority of the government because you're straight-up saying we're engaging in illegal activity. So what a lot of the early strikes of police and firefighters were actually mass sick-outs. So with the police, they coined the name, you might have heard of, Blue Flu. Firefighters, they call it the Red Rash. And teachers, they would call it Chalkboard Fever. So that would be where significant numbers of workers would not show up to work. And, during the period and when the contexts were right, they could get away with these tactics. So, for example, the air traffic controllers were able to use sort of slowdowns and sickouts throughout the 1960s and 1970s to build one of the most powerful and militant workers in the federal sector. Another set of tactics would be what's called currently called the inside game or work to rule, where workers would show up to work, but they would engage in various forms of slowdowns or refuse to perform certain services. So in the, I think we've seen this with graduate students recently and historically, or teachers, where the graduate students would, rather than go out on strike, they'd refuse to turn in the grades. They would grade all the exams, but they would refuse to hand them in. So it wasn't an all-out strike, but nonetheless, it was a means of putting pressure on the employer. Perhaps the most creative one example here was the civil service employees, the clerical workers in San Diego County in 1979, proclaimed that they were going to engage in what they called Human Error Day. They said, we get paid so low, what do we get paid to do? Make errors. So they began a campaign of making errors in all of their work, and one of them even got so carried away that they mistakenly issued a landfill for the county supervisor's front lawn. So those were kind of some of the creative tactics. Police down in Nashville, Tennessee, rather than go out on strike, did a pray-in at the Billy Graham's nightly prayer ceremony. So all the police, instead of showing up, went there. So anyway, throughout the period, they tried a lot of tactics. Some of the early teachers actually did these tactics called mass resignations. Rather than strike, they would say, we're all quitting, since, you know, at least at a theoretical level, it's supposed to be that workers are free to quit their jobs. Those tactics didn't work out that great, and it was abandoned. In the 1968 Florida statewide teacher strikes, the problem is the teachers, tens of thousands of teachers submitted their resignations. Then when the strike didn't quite end out like they wanted, individual school districts decided to just accept the resignations. So some tactics worked, some didn't.
The point is that workers were deciding to fight back and experimenting with tactics to help them gain power.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, one of the things that we learned from the period is that it wasn't staff kind of running the show, and it wasn't, outside organizers, saving the workers. What it was very much was an upsurge of the workers themselves. They were coming up with tactics, and, for the most part, they were incredibly successful. They were able to raise the level of public employee unionism from a small fraction of the labor movement to today constituting over half of the labor movement. They raised union density in the sector from 9% in the late 50s to roughly 40% by the mid-1970s. It was one of the great upsurges of labor history, and it was because of these sort of creative tactics, which are really bottom-up, worker-driven tactics.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. This is Labor Radio, and we are speaking with author Joe Burns about his new book, Strike Back. And another part of the story seems to be that women and people of color have been able to gain meaningful employment in the public sector through a set of policies, and because working conditions and wages have been improving in the public sector over time, the public sector wave of unionism has really benefited in large part women and people of color. And conversely, this attack on public employee unions impacts women and people of color disproportionately.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, there's an effort to basically dismantle the public sector, to destroy public service jobs, and to where they continue to exist, to try and impose the standards of the private sector upon the public sector. And that really hits at women and workers of color who have been the beneficiaries of unionism in the sector and in establishing concepts that should be the norm in society, such as comparable worth, paying, for example, clerical workers, paying them appropriately and not underpaying them versus male categories or male-dominated categories. Take teachers, for example. I mean, entering the 1960s, you know, the New York Times asked in an editorial, why would anyone become a teacher when you can make more as a unionized car wash worker? Yet, through strike activity in New York City throughout the 1960s, teachers, primarily predominantly female workforce, were able to fundamentally transform their conditions of employment. And it's the same with sanitation workers in the South. Through a powerful strike that tied in with the civil rights movement, workers not only in Memphis, which were familiar with the strike in 1968 in Memphis because of the assassination of Martin Luther King, but in cities such as, you know, Jacksonville, Atlanta, you know, cities throughout the South and even Southwest, sanitation workers were able to transform their jobs and gain dignity at work. So unionism has been extremely important for the certain groups of workers.
Let's end on something that you may or may not talk about in your book. I'm interested in public-private sector solidarity. Do you have a vision of how we get our private sector unions and our public sector unions that, as you say, have, you know, there's different forces at work in deciding which tactics to use, but how ultimately do we build one labor movement and trust across both sides? Do you see any sort of unifying vision that can bring us together?
Yeah, I think as, labor scholar and historian Joseph McCartan, who wrote the excellent book on the PATCO strike, has said, that there are not two labor movements in this country, there's one, and their fates are inextricably woven together. And that's really the case. You find that the strike activity of public sector workers, you know, often peaks and declines at the same time as the private sector. So the same forces, although they impact, you know, somewhat differently, but the same forces and the same enemies attacking public sector workers are attacking private sector workers. So I think one of the actual questions that I grapple with in this book are questions with both public and private sector workers face. And in reality, for example, you know, in many states, public sector workers do not have the legal right to strike. And in those that they do, they're extremely restricted and under attack. Private sector workers, although, you know, there's a claim that we have the right to strike, we don't have a right to a meaningful strike. Workers can be permanently replaced, i.e. fired for striking, and tactics capable of winning a strike have been outlawed. So that's why we're down to 6% in the private sector for the unionization rate, and obviously public sector unionism rate is higher, but that's under attack as well. So one of the questions in the book, and I think one of the key questions facing the labor movement, is how do we confront repressive labor law? And that's really an area where all workers can learn from the experience of the 1960s. Striking was illegal in every state in the United States until the late 1960s and continued to be illegal in the vast majority of jurisdictions. Yet hundreds of thousands of workers were able to successfully violate labor law, and they didn't really think of it as straight up just, oh, we're going out and violating labor law. They viewed it as they were standing on their constitutional and human rights to strike. And they were willing to take incredible sacrifice. Teacher leaders, would be jailed and sent to jail, but through mobilization, workers were able to use solidarity and able to win those strikes. And I'll give you just an example or two. And often that solidarity came from the private sector labor movement. One example was Philadelphia, which I just did a book event there last night. And in, I think it was 1974, they had a what the New York Times described as a particularly nasty teacher strike. And there was actually teacher at my book event who had participated as a young teacher in that strike and talked about how intense it was. But the key breakthrough in the strike came when the city got an injunction against the strikers and went all over the city to in front of the schools where these teachers were peacefully picketing and threw them into police vans and arrested 400. Well, the city labor movement was outraged and passed a resolution calling for what they called a day of conscience, which in reality was a one-day general strike of all workers, unionized workers in Philadelphia. That's how outraged they were. And the strike was, they were so outraged and it was so effective, that threat, that the strike, the teacher strike settled on the eve of the threatened general strike. That happened in Charleston as well when longshore workers in 69 said they would go out on strike, and that ended the strike. So I think we can learn that, you know, I think often people there back then viewed it as one labor movement and worked together through solidarity.
That's an incredible story, Joe. Well, thank you so much for sharing some of the themes and ideas in your book. Thanks for being on the show.
Great. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That's it for this edition of Labor Radio. Up next is Prison Pipeline. Let's end with a song we love to play on the show. And a big congratulations to former Labor Radio host Al Bradbury, who recently won the contest for Best New Labor Song at the 2014 Great Labor Arts Exchange in Silver Spring, Maryland. We'll listen to the winning song, If the Workers Take a Notion, which borrows a few lines from Joe Hill. See you next Monday.
If the workers take a notion, we can stop the speeding train. Every ship upon the ocean, we can tie with mighty chains. Every wheel in the creation, every mine and every mill, fleets and armies of all nations, will at our command stand still. I was glued to Al Jazeera, weren't you, weren't you? As the people took down Ben Ali and then Mubarak too, and they took no compromise, they stood their ground. That brought it down. I guess what Joe Hill said was true. And in Egypt, they know it too. If the workers take a notion, we can stop the speeding trains. Every ship upon the ocean, we can tie with mighty chains. Every wheel in the creation, every mine and every mill. Well, Wisconsin bowled me over. How about you? How about you? How they took that building over, built the city in it too, and the Capitol was shirted up in red, and the leaders followed when the people led. I guess what Joe Hill said was true, and in Wisconsin they know it too. If the shivering in my boots, well, haven't you, haven't you? Since the earthquake hit Japan and all those safe reactors blew, and as the U.S. launches yet another war, sometimes I want to stay home and lock the door. But if what Joe Hill said was true, there's a lot we've got to do. If the if the workers take the notion, we can stop the speeding trains. Every ship upon the ocean, we can tie with mighty chains. Every wheel in the creation, every mine and every mill, fleets and armies of all nations, will at our command stand still.
KABU wants you. Yes, you. Are you excited about the new possibilities for local independent media? Are you ready to help KABU reach out and grow stronger in the community? We're looking for candidates for KABU's board of directors, and we've extended our search through July 31st. So if you'd like to share your skills with the people who share your values, download a copy of our board candidate package at kboo.fm. Or you can pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. July 31st, so don't delay. And we look forward to seeing more of you at KABU.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7. I'm your host, Peter Pincel, and I'm here tonight with Patty Katz. And she's going to be talking with us about the exciting stuff she's doing around the Ban the Box campaign. But first, why don't you introduce yourself a little bit, Patty? Tell us where you're coming from.
Okay, well, my name is Patty Katz, and this is an issue that's near and dear to my heart. As a formerly incarcerated person, I want to do things to be able to make